Welcome to All About Business with me, James Reed, the podcast that covers everything about business, management, and leadership. Every episode, I sit down with different guests who have bootstrapped companies, masterminded investment models, or built a business empire. They're leaders in their field, and they're here to give you top insights and actionable advice so that you can apply their ideas to your own career or business venture. From the swinging 60s fashion rails to the front line of cutting-edge medical research, today's guest has reinvented herself more than once. I'm joined by Jennifer Rosenberg, OBE, entrepreneur, former fashion manufacturer for some of the UK's best-known retailers, and founder of the Heart Cells Foundation. We'll dive into resilience, reinvention, and what it takes to turn hard moments into meaningful impact for thousands of people. Well, today on All About Business, I couldn't be more delighted than to welcome Jennifer Rosenberg, who has had three amazing careers, and we're going to talk a little about each of them. Jennifer, you started out at Marks & Spencer's and was promoted on numerous occasions to a very senior role there earlier in your career. Then you started your own business, J&J Fashions.
That's right.
Which became the largest privately owned ladies' wear manufacturer in the country, employing thousands of people. And then you started the Heart Cells Foundation, which is pioneering really exciting new research to help people with heart disease and heart conditions. And I want to talk to you about that as well. But firstly, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me, James.
It's a real pleasure to see you. Thank you for coming in. Let's go back to the beginning and those swinging 60s, because I believe that you were the person with your team who introduced the mini skirt to Marks and Spencer's, no less.
What happened? Well, first of all, I started in M&S in the post room. So I really started at the bottom, pushing a post trolley around, delivering the mail. But I didn't intend to stay there. And, you know, after various meetings with staff management and everything, I found myself in the skirt department. I was very happy to be in the skirt department. But at that time, I wasn't the senior buyer of the skirt department. I was very junior. But I could see what was happening in London. This was the beginning of the 60s. It was every day there was something new that was happening in the scene. And Mary Quant developed something called the miniskirt. And prior to that, we'd been wearing skirts down to our calves, our ankles. And suddenly, this amazing designer called Mary Quant and this wonderful model called Twiggy was walking around London in these miniskirts. And I felt, well, we've got to have this. We've absolutely... So I bought one for myself, and fortunately I've got good legs, so that was okay. That went down very well. And I made a presentation to the board, and I said to them, we have to try this look. This is what's happening on the high street. And they ummed and they ahed, and I put it up against myself, and because I'm quite short, it didn't look,
Sorry to interrupt you at this point, just to help me visualize this. Was the board all male?
Yeah.
So it was men. There were no women on.
No women at all.
And they were probably all of a certain age.
So definitely, definitely.
And they had a reputation for being quite staid, Marks and Spencer.
Yes, but they were staid, but they were involved.
They
were very much into merchandise. They really would feel the fabric, look at the fabric. And they also had an amazing way of communicating with us. They were brilliant. So they'd walk in and they'd say, what's new? So I immediately got hold of my sample of this miniskirt and I said, sir, I feel we should be trying this. This is what's happening on the high street. Then I put it up against myself and it didn't look that short.
Why is that, Jennifer?
Because I'm short.
Because of course you are. So it looked quite long on you.
No, it looked quite reasonable on me. So in fact, it was Teddy Seaf at the time. He was the chairman.
Well, he's a famous retailer.
Absolutely. And he said, well, and they used to call you by your maiden name. So my name was Levine. So he said, well, Miss Levine, okay, well, if you think we should try it, let's try it. So we'll try. We worked in dozens in those days. So we'll try 50 dozen, which was nothing for them when they were buying. And of course, we made them, put them out, and they just walked off the counter within a day. I mean, it was
50
just
50 dozen,
surreal.
I like that.
Well, we always worked in dozens there, which is like 600
for everyone 600 else listening.
Skirts, absolutely.
For pre-decimalisation.
Even after decimalisation, we worked in dozens.
Did you?
Always in dozens.
I wonder why that was.
I don't know.
Just tradition.
Just tradition, absolutely. Well, it was a very traditional firm, but they had vision, and that was so important, and they realised that what was happening in the high street in the 60s was changing ladies' fashion. In fact, it was changing everything. It was changing the music business. It was changing hair. You had Vidal Sassoon, who created that amazing cut that Mary Quant had and Twiggy had. I mean, the whole scene was changing.
Even Reed Employment began in 1960. Well, here we go, 7th of May, 1960.
So it was a brilliant time. Your father had great vision and knew this was the time to start.
Well, it was a time for new ideas, wasn't
it? Exactly. Everybody was thirsty and hungry for new ideas.
And he was definitely an ideas guy. Mm. So you found yourself in this amazing business where they were open-minded to
very
new
open-minded.
Ideas.
So open-minded.
And you were able to present what you
thought. I mean, I always remember when I bought for myself, there was a wonderful boutiques of stores called Coronel, and they bought beautiful merchandise from Paris. And I bought from there a velvet blazer, a brown velvet blazer. And I remember it like it was yesterday. And again, I brought it in and I showed it to my director at the time, which again was Teddy Seeb. And I said, "Sir, I feel this is something we should try." And he looked at it and he said, "Miss Levine, velvet's only for the evening." I said, "No, it's moving forward now, and people are going to be wearing velvet blazers during the day. Well, then try it." But this time, because it was such an expensive garment, we could only try 25 dozen. Got them in again. M&S made velvet blazers for the next 10 years. They never stopped. It became a fashion item that every woman wanted to have.
What colours were they?
Black and brown.
Just those two colours. That's
it's like Henry Ford with his car. You can have any colour as long as it's black.
But I'm picking up that you called him Sir, Teddy Seeb, and he called you Miss Levine. I mean, so the business environment's changed so much,
hasn't
it?
Totally.
This is an interesting perspective you're
but
changing.
But I find it strange when I maybe call somebody up and they immediately call me by my first name, because that isn't how we grew up.
No.
But that's the way the world is today. It's very different.
But Marks and Spencer then was, I mean, it's still a very successful and very good business, but then it was sort of undisputed leader.
Undisputed leader of the high street.
What qualities made it that, do you think?
Because we had to, quality was terribly important.
Quality.
Quality. All the factories that manufactured for M&S had to be of a certain standard. They couldn't be like sweatshops. They just couldn't. They had to be had proper facilities of this. M&S insisted on having the right facilities for their staff. They had canteens in all their shops so girls could have breakfast or lunch, and they insisted that the manufacturers had the same facilities. They had to be clean, they had to have canteens for the girls to have lunch, and if you smoked, in those days people smoked, you had a smoking room.
Right. So they were ahead of their time in that
way.
Way
ahead of their time.
Was most of the manufacturing done in Britain then as well?
At that time, everything was done in Britain, on their label.
So all the sourcing was made in Britain?
Maybe not the fabric, but I would say 100% of actual manufacturing was done in the UK.
So that's totally changed.
Totally changed now.
Yeah.
It's a totally different world. I mean, you buy something, a skirt or a bra, and it's made in Bangladesh or it's made in Kuala Lumpur, wherever.
Right. And you don't know what the conditions are in those factories at all.
Well, they are. They're sweatshops. Do you remember that terrible, I think it was it either Bangladesh or Pakistan, where they had that terrible
fire? There was a fire. Yes, I do.
And a lot of people were killed. And I mean, those factory conditions were appalling.
So it's interesting. So why do you think that those standards that were so successful then were allowed to fall away?
Well, they haven't fallen away in the UK. It's because people have gone overseas.
Well, that's what's happened, isn't it? But I mean, people in the UK are happy to buy things from these places.
I will tell you a funny little story. Right? Before going into the skirt department, I was in the accessory department. And I was very junior then. And we were buying Chanel crochet berets from Italy. These Chanel berets were all handmade by artisans living all around Florence, but they would come to a central point where they would be collected. So I went to this central point, which was a factory, to check these berets out. And each worker had been given a shape which they had to make these hand crochet berets to. Anyway, being a lady, I suddenly decided I need to go to the lavatory. So I said, where can I go? And there was a lot of hissing and talking behind hands and everything. And suddenly the next thing, I find myself in a car being taken to somebody's home to use the facilities because all they had in the factory was a hole in the floor.
Right.
So I thought this was terribly funny.
Right.
So when I went back and I told my boss, you know, this story about what had happened, he was horrified. And the manufacturer's agent was called in and said, unless they put proper facilities in that factory, they're cancelling all the contracts. And that's how they operated, because they felt that you should have proper facilities everywhere.
Yeah.
And they were, their high standards really created the amazing business that they had and the quality of the merchandise that they made.
Yeah, so it's a real message around focusing on quality.
Quality was second to none.
And treating people properly.
And treating people. And I always remember another instance, again with Teddy Sieve. There's something with tweeds. Again, tweeds were manufactured in various countries, and we used to buy a lot of them. But there's a fabric called bull's wool, which is where the offcuts of the fabric was made, and it was cheaper. It felt very coarse. He would always feel a skirt and say, "This can't be bull's wool because we're not buying it." Mm. So, and they had their own quality control in the building. They had their own team of quality control people. They had their own laboratories. They were way, way ahead.
Reed.co.uk is giving away 1 million free job listings to employers across the UK. Whether you're filling dozens of roles over the next few months or looking for your next team member right now, Reed.co.uk can find them for free. No catch, no long-term commitments, just more businesses being able to find their perfect hire. Act quickly. These listings aren't free forever. Visit reed.co.uk/million job giveaway today and be part of 1 million opportunities to love Mondays. So Teddy Sieve, I mean, you've mentioned him several times.
Yeah, I know,
times.
Because he was my boss.
He was your boss, but I mean, he, for younger listeners, was a very famous retailer, entrepreneur, businessman in the 20th century. What did you learn from your boss? What would be carried forward into this era?
What I learned was, first of all, I think he was a wonderful communicator. You know, he was the chairman of this public company, and I was a kid in my 20s. He knew exactly who I was. He would come in, he would have a conversation with me. He would communicate with me. And I think that was an amazing, amazing way to operate. And all the senior board operated like that. They would go down to Marble Arch, talk to the customers, see what was happening, what was selling, come back. And they knew that business inside out.
So they were very keen to talk to people who were
absolutely.
On the shop floor, customer facing, and learn from them.
And they would make a point of talking to the sales assistants, because the sales assistant would know more than anybody else what the customer wants.
Yes.
I mean, and they regarded everybody as being important, you know, from the shop assistant to the buyer to the senior buyer, they treated us all equally.
Very good. That's a very important message. Mm. You started out, you said, in the post room. So I suppose that was a good way to get to know everyone, because you were delivering the mail.
No, I got to know everybody. I didn't stay in the post room very long. I was only there 2 weeks.
But 2 weeks, okay.
I went into the accounts department. That's where I got to know everybody, because in those days you had things like checks.
Right.
And the checks had to have two signatures. So every check had to have the company secretary's signature on it. Mr. Goldberg, I remember him like it was yesterday. And then I was given the job, because I was young and cute, I was given the job of them finding directors to get the second signature on. Well, I didn't find them. They'd phone around. And there were various members of the board, like the Sackers and the Laskys. And they were mature gentlemen, and they were very happy when I came in to have a conversation. They didn't have much to do other than sign these checks, have a cup of coffee. And they were, so I got to know them all. So I would say that I learned about more people in the accounts department than I did in the post room.
But so this point about making time to talk to people, it feels like in many businesses, that's been lost.
I think it is being lost, because you've got all this technology today. People are texting, they're sending emails, they're losing the art of communication. So I have a little saying. I always say to myself, it pays to talk. And I think it's so important to pick up the phone and have a conversation with somebody rather than keep sending texts and emails.
It pays to talk.
It pays to talk.
My version of that is talk before you type.
Oh, okay.
Because
right.
I agree.
Well, there we are. We're on the same wavelength.
We are.
James,
I think you're
you
more likely to get things done if you talk
Absolutely.
To someone.
Absolutely. I agree with you. I couldn't agree with you more because an email is very black and white and it can be dangerous.
Yeah.
Whereas when you have a conversation, you can just, if there's a, you can feel there's a situation developing, you can diffuse it.
Yes. So how many years were you at Marks & Spencer's?
I was at Marks & Spencer for 14 years.
And then you branched out on your own,
then
which is
I
exciting.
Branched out
so
on
this
my
is
own.
Career number two.
This is, so I left your, career number one where yeah. I was flying high. I was really...
So what was your last job there before?
My last job was in Ladies' Separates, and Separates had grown. I started off with a small skirt range, but from there we developed a trouser range. They didn't have trousers. Then we developed jackets, and the whole thing grew. It was like, it was growing at such a fast rate, we didn't quite realise how big it was. It was enormous. It was quite funny with trousers, because we developed these fit and flare trousers, and we couldn't get enough production. So... Again, when the board would go round to different manufacturers, anyone that had Hoffman Press suddenly became a trouser manufacturer overnight. We were pulling in production from everywhere.
What's a Hoffman Press?
Oh, a Hoffman Press, right. It's a big, it's two pads, and you just clamp it down, and it steams and presses. So you put a trouser leg under it, and you get the crease.
Oh, I see.
But you use it for other things as well. You don't only use it for trousers. You can use it for... But it's that it's all been modernised now. I shouldn't think any industry uses a Hoffman press today.
That's why I wanted to make sure I knew what it was. So in 1974, you left and started your own business.
I started my own manufacturing business called J&J Fashions, supplying who else but Marks & Spencer.
So you had left on good terms, obviously.
I left on very good terms. In fact, they gave me a golden handshake, which was very nice. In fact, I actually left on the Christmas of 73, and we opened our doors to our factory January 74, which you're far too young to remember, but that was the days of Edward Heath and Harold Wilson, and we had a three-day week.
No, I do remember that. Yeah, I do remember. Yeah, it wasn't a great time probably to start a business.
It was a terrible time to start a business. You could only work for 3 days a week.
So how did you deal with that? I mean, what happened?
Well, what happened was my husband was also a very large manufacturer to M&S, and he had a factory nearby that had a generator. So he would use the generator for the 2 days that he wasn't working, and then I would borrow the generator for the 2 days that we weren't working.
Oh, so it was on a truck, was
on
it?
On a truck, absolutely.
So what did you make? What were your first?
My first contract was ladies' trousers.
Ladies' trousers.
Yeah.
So describe them. What did they look like?
Well, if I say fit and flare, would that mean
flared
anything?
Trousers?
Flared trousers.
1974, yeah, I'm thinking flared trousers.
Flared trousers.
What material?
Crimpling. Crimpling crepe.
And people loved these,
They loved
I imagine.
These trousers, and the fastest colours were navy and black.
Right. So and this was sort of something people would wear.
Absolutely. Well,
daily.
Trousers were coming into people's wardrobes. They were new. They hadn't
because women
been,
didn't wear trousers.
Women didn't wear trousers.
So you've revolutionised.
Well, I always remember
fashion.
When we were at M&S, going back to M&S, and again, Teddy Seeve came in and he said, and trousers were selling incredibly well. He said, well, why are you girls not wearing trousers? Because we weren't. I said, well, we're not allowed to, sir. He said, well, from today on, you are allowed to wear them. I want to see you all in trousers.
That's good. So
so that's when, that would have been, I suppose, about 1970, 71, we were allowed to wear trousers.
So that gave you an idea this
Absolutely.
Was something that might be happening
Absolutely.
Everywhere. And then you grew that business and you
we
ended up with that, several factories.
We finished up in the end with 12 factories. We started our first factory in the northeast in Wallsend, and we finished up
Newcastle.
With about, Newcastle, that's right. Finished up with about 8 factories there. We were in Sunderland, Blyth, along the whole coast.
So Newcastle was your base?
Newcastle was our base.
Right.
And then we then branched into Yorkshire.
So what made you successful? I mean, because you became, I think, Businesswoman of the Year, Verve Clicquot, that smart champagne brand.
Absolutely.
Gave you the accolade.
And I still get my champagne every year on my birthday.
Oh, they still send it to you?
Yes.
Oh, all credit to them for that. So you were obviously very successful in this period.
Well, it was a very exciting time, again, because the 70s was a very prosperous time in the UK. And, you know, I had a wonderful relationship with Marks & Spencer. And I was able to develop that relationship from being a buyer there, knowing what the marketplace wanted, to becoming a manufacturer.
So what you've just described is an interesting opportunity, I think, for many people, is to become a supplier to your current company. You know, if you're working somewhere, what might be helpful to your current employer that you might be able to supply to them? Because when my father started this business in 1960, he recruited for Gillette, for instance, which is where he used to work.
Oh, right. Well, there you are.
And he also left on very good terms.
So it's a very similar scenario, isn't it?
Yeah. If you can leave on good terms and become a supplier to a company you work for, that's maybe a good way to get going.
Because they also value it, because they know that you know what they want and how they operate, and therefore you know their standards. I'll tell you a funny story with my first factory. So I marked going there, and it's a warehouse on an industrial site at Wallsend. So it's got to be painted. So I did a colour board. I got my colours sorted out and with the builder, and I decided the walls are going to be this colour. Anyway, when I go up there, they're not the same colour. They were a bright white, and I wanted a cream. So he said to me, I said, it's wrong. He said, it doesn't matter. It's only a factory. I said, it may only be a factory to you, but it's my factory. And I want the colours the way I chose them. So can you please change this colour? Right. I don't think anyone had ever spoken to him like that before.
But the colours were changed.
Yes, absolutely. Because if you're looking at bright white walls, it's very bad on your eyes. You want something softer, much softer, because you've got the bright lights on all the time.
Yeah.
So, yes.
So how many people worked in that factory?
In Wallsend, I suppose. When we started off with one line. Because when you're in production, you have lines of machines. So we started off with one line, gradually we built it up. And I suppose we probably finished up with about 100 in that factory.
So what made you open separate factories rather than just get a bigger factory?
Well, first of all, it was the space. I mean, factories take up a lot of room because you've got to have a machine and then you've got to have your pressing units at the bottom and your packing. It's a lot of footage required to manufacture garments. It's not like you're manufacturing cans of soup. You need a lot more room, a lot of room.
So you need a lot of room
a lot of space, a lot of space. And it was better. I mean, if you get too big, it's much more difficult to control than if you've got a system where, say, you've got 8 or 10 lines in a factory, you have a supervisor on each line, you have the merchandise being made in sections through the line, and then it comes to the bottom, it gets pressed, it gets packed. We just found that was a better way for most of the factories were that similar sizes, actually, if I think about
around it. Around 100
people. Yeah, around 100 people. Some were more. We had some more.
Yeah. Yeah. So what other items did you make?
Well, we finished up making everything in ladies' wear. We made dresses, skirts, obviously, had to make skirts, trousers, leisure wear, blouses.
So all ladies'
wear? All ladies' outerwear. No knitwear. We never touched knitwear.
Right.
We never touched menswear, but we covered all of it. And we didn't touch coats. We didn't touch coats, but we did everything else.
So you built this business up over an almost 20-year period, and then sold it, I believe, very successfully in 1992.
That's right.
Why did you sell it, or what was your strategy around
our
that?
Our strategy was that we'd grown our business, and my husband had done a couple of takeovers as well, because it was very difficult to grow organically, so we took over two other companies. And we were, you know, at the end of the day, we were made an offer we couldn't refuse. We had a very successful ladies' wear clothing business. We were very design orientated. We were making merchandise that was selling incredibly well. So we had something. We were innovators. Therefore, we had something that was very attractive to our competitors.
Right. So who bought the business?
A company called Claremont, who were a public company. But they, you know, to have a design is a very expensive part of a business because you have to employ designers and you have to travel. You have to invest a lot of money to have good design, which we did. And they were more into, they were much more into mass, big production. They wanted to cut costs, so they cut the design element down. So they cut the innovation out of the business. And when things get difficult, if you haven't got new merchandise coming through, you suffer.
So after they bought your business,
three
they
years
did that.
After they bought our business, they went bust.
Really?
Yeah.
So that must have been sad for you.
Was sad, but you know, my husband said to me, "Love me, don't love your business." So I mean, we I walked away.
That's easy to say and hard to do, probably.
I'd been in the business. We had the business now 20 years. I was very happy to walk away.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd done an awful lot in that time. You know, since I'd left school and worked for Marks and Spencer, then I'd ran a business. And I was quite happy, you know, this offer came along. It was a very good offer. So I was happy to walk away. Yes, of course I was sad when they messed the business up. But equally, it was, you know, I knew they were going to mess it up. Because if you don't invest in design, you're in trouble.
Well, what you just said about innovation is so important to any business.
Any business.
If you're not innovating, you become irrelevant. I
always remember when we bought this leisurewear factory and suddenly, you know, because I remember the start of leisurewear, of leggings, and it all, you know, all happening. And we took into M&S a pair of leopard skin leggings, and they looked at them in shock and horror, whatever. Again, we did a trial. Now I'm on the other side. I'm the manufacturer doing the trial. Well, we started, did a trial originally of 100 dozen. Fine. We sold in that one season 6,000 dozen pairs of these leggings. You can imagine how profitable that was for both of us.
Yes. Yes. So you were still innovating, right?
Oh, very much. That's how the business grew.
Of course.
Our business grew from being one line in a factory in Newcastle to employing 3,000 people because we innovated. And I was very good at innovating, as was my husband. He was brilliant on fabrics and textiles, and between us, we were an amazing team.
When you say I was very good at innovating, what made you very good at innovating? How do you think about innovation? How do you go about it?
I used to go to America about 3 or 4 times a year as a supplier to look at the shops, because the Americans were brilliant at taking high couture fashion and making it very commercial. And we'd pick up and buy merchandise and copy it.
Just have a look, yeah.
Have a look, absolutely. And we pick, I have a very good eye for seeing what's going to sell.
So being out there, really looking at what's available, what's going
on. Absolutely, so important. And America in that time, in the 70s and 80s, were the forerunners. Their stores were wonderful. They had amazing merchandise. So we copied.
Yeah. Well, we've had other guests on the podcast who've done very well in business saying exactly that.
I mean, we've sued a few times, but anyway, you always settle.
Sued a few times. That was a part of the cost
of doing business. Look, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. No, it was, so as I say, you have to innovate. As you say, today you have to innovate.
Yes.
I mean, look at Steve Jobs at Apple.
Yes. It didn't do so well when he wasn't there, when he returned.
No, then he came back. I mean, it's an amazing company.
Certainly is. So what do you think about these days? Very few companies manufacture clothing in Britain. What's changed? Why is that?
Because it was cost. I mean, at the tail end, before we sold out, we were manufacturing abroad as well. So we still had our big factory place in the UK, but we'd gone to Portugal, where we were manufacturing denim dresses. We'd gone to Morocco and we'd gone to Hong Kong.
Right. And you were doing that because it was becoming more and more expensive.
Because it was more and more. And also, if you wanted a garment that had a lot of work content in it, we couldn't afford it in our own factories because we couldn't pass that on to the retailer.
So that was because of labour costs, probably, was it? So it became more and more expensive to employ people. And the customers wouldn't entertain paying more for the product.
Well, the client wouldn't. Your customer wouldn't entertain paying.
Your customer being the retailer.
The retailer. And also other manufacturers were going abroad as well. Therefore, we had to compete with them.
So this was a trend that you had to go with. Because
Absolutely.
If you didn't, you'd go out
Absolutely.
Of business.
Absolutely.
So that was sort of globalization occurring,
And that was another reason. It was a perfect time to sell out.
Right.
Because I know that manufacturers spend their life chasing, going from one country to another to find the cheapest production.
So you sort of saw the writing on the wall.
We saw the writing on the wall.
I saw the writing on the wall. So then, coming to your third career.
My third career.
Third amazing career, I want to say, because it is amazing. You took a complete pivot and did something different.
Well, there's always a reason that things happen. I mean, my husband, we were enjoying retirement. We were traveling, we were doing lots of wonderful things, and life was good. Sadly, my husband developed a heart condition. He developed something called heart failure. And we went to see his cardiologist, who really gave him weeks to live. It was as black and white as that.
Sorry just to interrupt you with that. What is heart failure?
Heart failure is when it can occur three different ways. It can occur if you have a heart attack. It can occur if you have something called cardiomyopathy, or it can occur without for no reason.
Right.
And it's when the heart is a muscle. So when a muscle when you have heart failure, the heart becomes enlarged, and it can either be a heart attack or one of the other issues that can cause it. A virus can cause it. So therefore, when the heart becomes enlarged, it can't pump as well as it did before it was enlarged. Therefore, the body builds up fluid.
Right.
And that's what heart failure is, where you get fluid building up in your lungs. You find people with heart failure have swollen legs. You become very breathless. You can't walk upstairs. It's very, very debilitating.
Right. And he's sort of developed this condition.
And my husband developed this condition. And the only treatment other than a heart transplant is medication. And that it helps, but it does certainly doesn't cure.
Right. So you were in this situation.
We were in this situation.
What did you do?
Well, we went to see my husband's cardiologist, and he said, you know, he gave us the bad news that things were very grim, but he said he had recently been to a presentation given at Barts Hospital by a young cardiologist called Dr. Anthony Mather, who presented a paper on something that was called stem cell therapy. And this treatment was happening in Germany, in Frankfurt, where they were taking a patient's own stem cells and injecting them back into their heart.
So, sorry to keep asking you to explain things.
No.
What is a stem cell?
Oh, right. I must explain to anybody listening, I'm not a medical person.
No, but just as a heads up, what is it? Just as opposed to any other cell?
Yeah, the whole body is full of stem cells.
Right.
And you've got millions of stem cells in your body. You've got them in your blood. You've got them in your bone, and you've got them in your muscle. So that's what stem cells are. Your body is full of them. And this science that they were talking about in Germany, where they were extracting stem cells from the patient's body, and with heart failure, they'd worked out that the best place to take stem cells from was from the bone marrow. And they would then treat these stem cells in the laboratory, clean them and infuse them, and then inject them back into the patient's damaged heart. And they had scientific proof that by injecting them back into the damaged heart, it started to regenerate that damaged heart.
That sounds amazing. So they were literally injecting the heart with stem
cells?
Yes. And these were stem cells that had been harvested from another part?
Yes, and they were their own, but they were their person's own stem cells.
Right. And this was new science?
Brand new. Nobody, like you, I didn't know what stem cells were either. I mean, none of us knew. We'd never heard of them.
Right.
It was so new. We're talking now about 2003. So we're talking about 23 years ago.
So this cardiologist back in 2003 at St. Bart's Hospital here in London shared this information. But then you, as I understand, went to Germany.
Well, he told us it was happening in Germany.
Right.
And Ian, my husband, wasn't in his vocabulary at all. He never understood what the word no was. So he said, well, we've got to go. So Anthony said, okay. So he said, I want to go tomorrow. Anyway, by the next week, we all went. Anthony Mather came with us. We all were on a plane to Germany, to Frankfurt, where my husband had the treatment.
Right. And how long did that take?
The treatment itself, he was in hospital for 2 days, that's all.
Right. And what was the result?
The result was amazing. But when we came home, prior to going to Germany, he hadn't been able to walk up the stairs, because stairs are one of the big testing things when you have heart failure.
Right.
Within about 2 weeks, he was walking up the stairs. It was a miracle. It was like a light switch going on. It was unbelievable.
So then, based on this amazing result, you decided to set up a charity.
Well, it was Ian, really. He was so incensed that, because we were with Anthony, when you travel with somebody, you spend a lot of time and you have conversations, and it evolved that there was no money in the UK going for this research.
Right.
And Ian was appalled. He thought it was terrible that, you know, it was such an amazing thing that had happened to him that there was no money for pioneering this treatment in the UK. So he said to Anthony, how much do you need to start this trial here in the UK? So Anthony, I think he was being quite flippant, actually. He said, oh, I need about 6 million. So this is 2003-04.
Yeah.
So Ian said, I'll get it for you. And he did.
And so he raised 6 million and set up a charity to do this.
We set up the charity first and then we raised the money. Yeah.
And the charity is called the Heart Cells Foundation.
It's called the Heart Cells Foundation, yes.
And that was founded by you and Ian.
That's right.
Initially raised 6 million for this research.
Yeah.
And so that went to St. Bart's?
But the treatment was happening at St. Bart's, yes.
Yes.
But we have the most amazing relationship with St. Bartholomew's Hospital because we're a charity funding this treatment. We've been doing it. We've been working with them now for 21 years. And we don't put the money into a pool that gets just spread around everywhere. We are only paying for what they are treating. We pay for the technician that's dealing with it. It's a direct payment and it's working brilliantly.
So how's the treatment evolved and developed since 2003?
Well, they're obviously fine-tuning it as it's gone on. I mean, we now have a situation where we're treating... We did our 3 gold standard trials, which were very successful, and papers were published.
So what's the gold standard trial?
What's the gold standard trial?
Sounds like an important trial.
It is an important trial. We did three trials. We did one trial. They're called gold standard because it's the technique and the way they have to do them. But one trial was treating patients who'd had a heart attack. So when they were rushed to A&E, they were given the opportunity of having stem cells. The second one was patients who'd had a heart attack and developed an enlarged heart. And the third trial was where patients, for no reason, developed something called cardiomyopathy, which again is heart failure, but there's no reason. They haven't had a heart attack, they haven't had a stroke, it's just suddenly happened. And that tends to be much younger people.
Mm.
So we'd done those 3 different trials.
Mm. And the results?
The results were excellent.
Right.
I don't know whether you've had a chance to look at any of our case studies, but when you go on our website and you look at our case studies, the results are unbelievable.
So people who are interested in this, how do they find you, Jennifer?
Well, they find us if they go on our website, which is theheartcellsfoundation.com, and you look on there, you'll find all the information you need. You can register with us and we will contact you. And providing you tick all the boxes, you'll be able to receive this amazing treatment.
So tick all the boxes. In fact, you're a sufferer of heart failure of some form or other.
But you've medically got to tick the boxes because you may have other conditions as well. So
okay.
I'm not a medical person, but they have to go through our whole medical system. They have to have scans to make sure that they're suitable.
Right. And this is available to people?
This is available
free
across
of charge.
The country. Free of, well, the Heart Cell Foundation fund it.
Right.
It costs about £12,000 to treat a patient, but we fund it, yes.
Fantastic. And well, thank you and congratulations for doing that. That sounds fantastic. So you're now, as I understand it, seeking to expand this service and raise more money.
Well, what Ian's dream was that this treatment should be available across the UK in every National Health Hospital, not just where we're now, where it's now available at Bart. So to be able to roll it out across the country in all the various National Health Hospitals. We'd have to get that approved by NICE. We now have to do a larger trial. So to do the larger trial, we have to raise £8 to £10 million because we have to recruit about 600 patients to do this trial.
Right.
And we won't just do it at Bart's Hospital. We'll be doing the trial at different regional hospitals around the country.
Right. And when you do the trial, there's a control group. Is that right? So some people aren't given a placebo?
Oh, yes.
How does that work? And tell us what you're going to do about
that. That would be the same thing, because when you do a trial, say you're doing a trial of 600 patients, 300 will have the placebo and the other 300 will have, as I call it, the real deal.
So some of them think they're getting the treatment.
No, yeah, they don't know.
They don't know.
They don't know.
It's quite interesting.
This is the way the medical system in this country works. It's been constructed. I think it's universal, actually. I don't think it's just in the UK. I think it's everywhere. That when you do these medical trials, half the recipients have to have a placebo, will receive the placebo. So they don't know.
Right.
And then it's only when the trials get unblinded, and even say Professor Anthony Mather that started the whole, he wouldn't know.
Right.
Nobody knows.
So how long does the trial take?
Well, it depends. I think we probably took, we unblocked them probably after a year.
Right. So years worth of data.
But then that patient will be being checked up all through that year. They'll be coming back for checkups just to see what their heart infraction was.
Yes. Oh, well, I wish you every success
with that.
That's an amazing story. Is there anything you would say, looking at the health system more widely, would be welcome? I mean, there are lots of things you could think of, I imagine.
Well, I think the national health, when it works, is brilliant. And I think our relationship with Barts Hospital has been amazing. We're working with a national health hospital. We're a private charity. We have this incredible relationship. And I would love to, if you ever had the time, to come down to Barts and see the heart unit there. It is amazing. It is state of the art. It's probably the best heart center in Europe. It is brilliant.
I'd love to do that. Thanks for the invitation.
And we'll organise that for you this year. But it is... So my experience of working with them has been amazing. Okay. I know there are lots of problems and we hear about whatever, but I can't really express an opinion on it because I've not been involved in it.
So looking back on your career, you know, starting a charity, I imagine, is different from starting a business. Or is it similar? I mean, how did you navigate this?
I mean, we started this charity on the back of a cigarette packet. I mean, my husband went to Germany, Ian went to Germany, had the treatment, came back, felt $1 million. And somehow he got hold of a journalist. Don't ask me. I can't even remember how he connected with her, called Marianne Powers, who wrote for the Daily Mail. And she thought this story was amazing. And we got she was going to write a 2-page editorial for us in the Daily Mail. And at that time, we didn't even have a name for the charity. So she said, well, you've got to get a name. You've got to get registered. You need a board of trustees. All these things were thrown at us. And we just did it. I mean, we somehow, you know, we had a very dear friend who happened to be a high court judge who lived across the road. He became a trustee. The accountant became a trustee.
So you put this together quickly.
We cobbled it together very, very quickly because she said, when this article gets published, you're going to have so much money pouring in that you've got to have a charity. You've got to be a registered charity.
Of course.
So we started to register a charity and then we couldn't get a bank account.
Right.
But then we found a friendly banker at Hambro's and he opened a bank account for us. It was all done on the back of a cigarette packet.
But the story that the journalist was going to write was a real impetus to getting everything else put in place.
And I must tell you, so much money poured in. Oh, I'll tell you another story that evolved from that.
So communication's again important.
Exactly. Communication is so important. So she did two-page editorials. That's quite something to have. So she did one initially when Ian was going to Germany, and then she did another one about 6 months later after he'd been to Germany. And as I said, the money just poured in. But winding the clock forward, after the trials had now started, and we had what we called a patients' gathering, where a lot of the patients were invited down to Barts. And it was the day a lot of the trials were being unblinded. And this woman came up to me. She said, she gave me a big hug and a kiss. She said, I can't thank you enough. She said, when we read your first article in the Daily Mail, we decided we're going to sell our house and my husband's going to Germany to have this treatment. And then the second article came out and we read about this wonderful charity that you'd set up and that it was all going to happen at Barts. We applied and my husband was treated. She said, I have my husband still with me today, but we still have our house. And she said, I cannot thank you enough. So we both finished up crying. I mean, she was crying, I was crying. It was very emotional, very, very emotional.
And that's amazing. So,
but I do think communication is important at every level. I think if you have to ask me, the one thing young people really should try and learn today is how to communicate with people.
So when you look at the charity now, you know, it's different from a business in important respects, but how would you measure success when you evaluate the charity?
I think I look at two. First of all, it's the wonderful families I meet, because when you have something like heart failure, it's not just the patient that's affected, the whole family is affected. And I meet the families and I hear their stories, and it's very, very, very humbling, actually, when you hear, you know, how their lives have changed and what you've been able to do with them. And I also find it very satisfying when I see the checks rolling in.
Because so on that measure, you can still measure income.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm very on top of the financial side of things, because, you know, we have to. The compassionate unit takes about £500,000 a year to run,
and
we
and
have
the compassion unit is the one that reaches out.
The compassion is the one that's operating now.
Right.
That's running on a weekly basis, where we treat patients from all over the country. It's not a trial; it's just a regular unit.
Right.
Whereas the new trial that we're going to do, where we need to raise the £8 million for, that will be a trial where half the patients will have the placebo and the other half will have the real deal.
Right. And I suppose the other measure of progress or success is scientific progress.
Of course. I mean,
and you've seen that.
Well, we've seen it. And stem cells are now being used across the board, not just for heart failure, although it's the most advanced for heart failure. But it's being looked at for macular degeneration, liver disease, all sorts of things. Yes, science moves it. Science doesn't stop.
No, that's very satisfying. So just looking at your career as a whole, these three different amazing careers, chapters, let's call them, you've lived through several reinventions of yourself, from fashion to philanthropy. Mm. What connects, what if anything connects those chapters for you?
Well, I think the first and second chapter connected very easily, because I went from one scenario to another and I had Marks and Spencer in common. The third one just happened by default. But again, I put the same energy into running or chairing the Heart Cell Foundation as I did to running a business. I have meetings. I've had three Zoom meetings before I've come here to have this lovely conversation with you today, James.
That's two more than I've had.
And I like Zoom meetings because I can see the person.
Yes.
I am a visual person. I really am.
You prefer that to talking on the phone?
Yeah, I prefer that. Talking on the phone's okay, but I when I'm talking like to our office, I do it always on Zoom because I like to connect.
Right. So the common theme I'm hearing, it maybe, is energy.
I've got a lot of energy.
I'm seeing that. So, and you've said, I mean, I've done my homework. You've said you never want to retire.
No, I never want to retire. I'm not somebody that, I like doing things. I like having something to aim for. I love having a list of jobs to do that I can cross off at the end of the day. And I do have a lot of energy. I really do.
Yeah, I can see. So, you know, this is an important theme, energy. What do you do personally, if I might ask you, to ensure that you are fit and energetic and feel up for the day? Is there any advice you can give of us?
I've always believed in some form of exercise. I mean, it depends on, you know, what you're able to do.
So what do you do?
Well, I have a back issue, so I'm quite limited, but I do Pilates and I have a physio who comes twice a week. And I think walking is very important. I think if there's an easy way to go somewhere or a longer way to go somewhere, I take the longer way. And I think going up and down steps is very important.
Just moving.
Moving. I think it's really, sitting all day in front of a screen, it can't be good for you.
No.
It really can't
be. So keep moving.
Keep moving.
That's your message. Excellent. And what sort of impact do you hope to have over the next decade in terms of the work that you're doing now for the next generation?
What we're hoping is that we get this phase three trial up and running. Because that will be amazing. That will be fulfilling Ian's dream that this treatment will be available across the UK. Because heart failure is one of the biggest killers in this country. It's far bigger than any cancer. It really is very, very, it's very debilitating. It affects the whole family. It also affects the economics of the country, because people with heart failure cannot work.
Yes.
And that's the other thing we found so amazing, is that so many of our patients now have gone back to work.
Right.
And that's brilliant, isn't it? It's very satisfying for them, but it's also good for the country.
It doesn't sound, I think you said that it was £12,000 a person.
It's not expensive.
No, it doesn't sound ridiculously expensive.
No, it isn't expensive at all.
So to make that more widely available.
And I mean, the hospital time is minimal. And we now also have some patients that don't, they'll go, if they live nearby, they won't even stay in hospital.
Right.
So it's non-invasive. You get no rejection. I mean, when you have a heart transplant, which costs, I think, it costs about £300,000 a heart transplant, you've got the chance of rejection, whereas this you don't.
So this is something to prevent that.
Absolutely.
Ideally.
I was to work along. I mean, you're very restricted. You only have about 100 heart transplants a year.
Right. Well, you have to have someone else's heart.
Absolutely. And
which
lot of,
a starting
you know,
point,
so
which
therefore,
isn't great.
And you don't always have a match. You know, you have to, you may have a heart, but it may not be a match for you.
Yeah. So this is a good route to go.
So this, I mean, I think stem cells are the biggest medical breakthrough of the 21st century. It's really going to revolutionize so many different illnesses.
I mean, looking back over your remarkable life and career, is there anything you would like to advise or recommend your young self from what you've learned in the journey since you were 20?
Well, when I look back on what I've done, I'm amazed at what I've done and how I didn't have any fear. When I think of what I was doing in my 20s, I was a kid, but I didn't really have any fear whatsoever. I feel that anything I wanted to do, I was able to do.
So it sounds like you would have recommended to your younger self, carry on in a
absolutely,
fearless fashion.
Absolutely. But I think when you're young, you don't have fear. It's like if you learn to ski when you're young, you're fearless. When you learn to ski at my age, which was 40, it wasn't the same scenario.
No.
But I do, when I look back and I think what I did in my 20s, it was unbelievable. Unbelievable. But I think a lot of that was because I was very fortunate to be in that position that I was in, where I was dealing with very senior business directors who had a lot of support, had a lot of confidence. They felt very, what's the word I'm looking for? They felt, they had a lot of confidence in us. They thought we were, I mean, it takes something when you take a big public company and they get rid of all their senior buyers and put young kids in their 20s in that position. You've got a lot of courage to do things like that.
They were pretty fearless too.
They were very fearless. They were very fearless.
So there's a buccaneering spirit we're getting
buccaneering,
here.
Buccaneering, that's the word.
That's buccaneering what we need to hold
spirit.
On
that's
to.
That's it, absolutely.
Buccaneering
absolutely.
Spirit that every entrepreneur
but
should.
But you see, I always feel that my solution now is there's always a solution to any problem. As problems occur, and they do for me in various ways, there's always a solution. And we can always find that solution.
Through innovation.
Through innovation, absolutely.
Well, I wish you every success
Thank
with that.
You very
I really
much,
hope
James.
That trial is up and running soon and that we're well, able to extend this wonderful innovation and service to a lot more people.
Well, thank you very much for giving me your time today and explaining what I'm doing. And I hope you'll accept my invitation to come to Barts.
Now, I always ask two questions at the end.
Oh, okay.
Jennifer, of all my guests. And so I'm going to ask you, the first question is, because we love Mondays at Reed, what is it that gets you up on a Monday morning?
What is it that gets me up in the morning? Well, I always have early appointments, deliberately, because I'm not the best at getting up early. So if I have a 9 o'clock meeting in my diary, I have to be up for it, and I have to be ready for it. I mean, I always do my hair, I always put my makeup, I always get dressed. I'm so old-fashioned. Even when we were in lockdown, I did that every morning.
Oh, good for you. It's important to uphold standards.
I think it is. Standards, I think, are terribly important. That was something else I learned at M&S, standards.
Right. And my last question, which is an interview question from my interview book, Why You, is where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
Well, I'd like to still be here in 5 years' time. I don't know. First of all, the trial will be up and running then, definitely in 5 years' time, and we will have made enormous progress, and it will be much more well-known than it is currently. And me personally, just doing more of the things I enjoy doing. I mean, I love going to I'm very involved with the art world, which I enjoy. I play bridge. I've got a lot of interests as well as my charity.
Very good. Well, I wish you all the very best with all of those things. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for
inviting
me
today.
Me.
It's been a real pleasure. I so enjoyed the conversation.
Me too. It's been lovely.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer, for joining me on All About Business. I'm your host, James Reed, Chairman and CEO of Reed, a family-run recruitment and philanthropy company. If you'd like to learn more about Reed or the Heart Cells Foundation, you'll find all the links in the show notes. See you next time.